Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I explore some of the lesser-known psychedelics, specifically MDA, salvia, and canna. We discuss the case reports, limited research, and some cautionary tales on these substances, and provide some harm reduction education along the way. If any of you listening are looking for good training and education programs pursuant to becoming a psychedelic therapist, check out Numinous' programs. You can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection and use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing to the show on whatever podcast player that you're listening to us on or on YouTube. You can leave us a review or a rating in places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and please share the episode with somebody you think might find it interesting. Please enjoy today's episode. And here we are yet again for another episode of Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers.
Hey, Steve.
How are you doing?
Good. Good. Well.
Doing well. Yeah. My dad would be very disappointed if I would have responded, doing good.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
The English professor. You're doing well, Steven. You're not doing good. Oh, it's okay. Sorry. Nice shirt, Reed. For the few of you who watch on YouTube, you can see that Reed's wearing a Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers shirt.
It's one of like two different PTF shirts on the planet. Because we gave one away once to a listener. It's pretty cool with the tracing of their favorite episode. Mm-hmm. And then this one I just made the other day while texting back and forth with you of, we need some swag. I want a Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers shirt. Yeah. So I hurried and made a graphic in about 2 minutes on Canva, dragged it into Sticker Mule, and a few days later I had a $15 shirt show up at my door that I quite like.
It's cool. It's got a few of our one-liners from our quotes down there.
Yeah. I'll make it possible for people to access this, maybe for charity or something.
Yeah.
One of these days. I have an idea.
So for those of you who would be interested in Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers merch, let us know. Mm-hmm. Somehow. Email us or go to the YouTube video, comment on it.
I'll make you a bandana, Steve.
That's what I need. I need to look more like a pirate than I currently do. Mm-hmm. So it would have been cool to have something like that ready for psychedelic science. Walk around with our merch.
Yeah.
We'll have to think about next time we go to a conference, we can shamelessly self-promote.
Drop some from a helicopter or something.
I'm thinking t-shirt cannon. They have those at sporting events and shoot up into the stands. How would that be if we just walk around a conference with a t-shirt cannon? Shooting.
Dangerous, but good
knocking
idea.
People over. Hey, you want a t-shirt? I didn't want a concussion, but yeah. Cool. So today we thought we would cover some of the less popular psychedelic compounds, popular in the psychedelic medicine space. They aren't being researched as actively as some of the other medicines, but have been used historically for therapeutic purposes, for recreational purposes, for personal growth or spiritual exploration purposes. We will say, of course, like we've disclaimed on the podcast before, we don't encourage the use of illicit substances. And some of the things we're going to be talking about today, some of the factoids and tidbits come from anecdotes. So not thoroughly researched necessarily.
But a good topic, because we get asked about these a lot. Mm-hmm. Like people ask more and more about what is MDA, how does it compare to MDMA, mm-hmm. or what the heck is with salvia?
Yeah, yeah.
That crazy medicine drug plant.
Right.
Whatever you call it. We'll talk about what you call it. And canna. Like right. We were at the conference and someone was giving out canna tinctures. Mm-hmm. So I like to know what is in things that people ask you to consume personally, just a personal stance.
Seems like a good personal stance to have. Yeah.
Not only what is in them, but what it does. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was interesting at the conference. So many vendors having their own little blends of things or making claims about certain compounds. Canna is one I've heard be brought up a lot in, sort of the, psychedelic journey space. People talk about, or even sell canna. Like we talked about canna extracts for a variety of uses, but mm-hmm. we'll dive into a little bit.
Yeah. I've seen that one in the ecstatic dance circles being passed around as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So why don't we start with, you mentioned MDA, and it's often talked about in conjunction with MDMA. What is MDA?
MDA is, I think it's growing in popularity, but dates back decades. In fact, I'll hold this up for the small percentage of listeners who are watching this on video. My battered, well-worn copy of The Healing Journey by Claudio Naranjo. He actually has a whole chapter in here on MDA, the drug of analysis. Mm. And I'll be excited to share with you, Steve, what I pulled out of that, his opinions on how MDA can be used therapeutically, and see what you think. But to back up a little bit, it was discovered in 1912-ish. Researcher, what's his name? Gordon Alice, who discovered amphetamine, was looking for a vasodilator. And he synthesized this thing called MDA. Kind of like somewhere related to amphetamine, MDMA, chemically similar to mescaline. Mm. And so he took it thinking it might be useful in blood pressure related conditions. So he puts a little blood pressure monitoring thing on his finger, and he takes the medicine, and his laboratory notes on this self-experimentation, as they did back then, this is probably what, the 50s? Mm. He wrote that he became more talkative, excessively talkative, and he saw these yellow smoke rings start to appear in the room. And that's when he was like, I'm onto a psychedelic, gonna call my psychedelic friends. And he gave some to the Shulgins, gave some to Claudio Naranjo. That's kind of where it began.
Hmm. So you mentioned that made him more talkative, and that it's sort of stimulating, right? So how is it different from MDMA? We don't have to get into like chemistry details, because I wouldn't even know where to start, not being a chemist. But
yeah, so it's similar in that it's a stimulant, has stimulating properties. It has mild psychedelic effects, always dose dependent, or usually dose dependent, of course. But because of that increased empathy, sociability, people often lump it as like similar to or somewhere in between MDMA and classic psychedelics. Mm-hmm.
Right. So not uncommon to be used in sort of a so-called recreational context at like a concert or a party because of those empathogenic, sort of entheogenic or more empathogenic properties. Makes you, as you stated, more sociable. Sometimes you'll hear it referred to as a heart opener. Which is often what they refer to MDMA as, because it just makes you more lovey-dovey, I guess. Yeah.
So it's about a 6-hour journey, like MDMA. Less attention paid to the come down the neurotransmitters, even though it works similarly, like serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, without the oxytocin effects. But less of an empathogen, still some qualities, more of a, you know, some more psychedelic properties than MDMA, mm-hmm. but less kind of relatively speaking than some of the others. But I like how Claudio Naranjo called it the drug of analysis.
Yeah.
So he is kind of like the Stan Grof of Latin America, from Chile. And he wrote The Healing Journey, like I held up, and another one, like My Psychedelic Explorations, I think. And he's a clinician, a psychiatrist who worked with mescaline, worked with iboga, worked with ayahuasca, because he's, you know, from Latin America, and right. sat with just countless people in his clinic at the University of Chile. And he said he was in a kind of a good position to do it there, because there was no drug scene and there was no drug scandal, really, in terms of psychedelics. So he could use whatever was given to him without the drama of the USA and the war on drugs. And so he did. He gave it to people in clinic. And why he called it the drug of analysis is because he meant the drug of psychoanalysis, because it seemed to him to induce this spontaneous regression into childhood parts in his clients. So they would like, and he found it especially well suited for healing childhood trauma.
Mm-hmm. So maybe similar to MDMA, because we talked in a recent episode about, well, I guess it was in our recap of the conference where I discussed a little bit how Bessel van der Kolk talked about MDMA assisted therapy being particularly helpful in spite of his initial hypothesis, being particularly helpful for developmental trauma, for childhood related issues. Right?
And so I like how Claudio Naranjo describes these things or categorizes psychedelics, and maybe we just throw out our current categories for now of these empathogens and look at his two broad categories. One is as like feeling enhancers and one is fantasy enhancers. Mm. And so he has this view that feeling enhancers are more useful than fantasy enhancers. This is debatable, right? But interesting. I wanted to get your thoughts because he says that if you can reconnect with your emotional world, that can open up the potential for more depth in your own spirituality and your ability to love, right? Mm. And he says, as opposed to some of the classic psychedelics that may occasion a mystical experience, Roland Griffiths might debate this because we just heard him speak in Denver on the lasting impact of a mystical experience, right? But I think we're all talking about the same thing, and it's interesting to tease apart. So he says that a feeling enhancer kind of gets you on this pathway to being able to love, and in his opinion, has more potential. And I think many people would say that about MDMA therapeutically than, even though the potential is huge for, and the risks, of course, huge across many of these medicines, it's an interesting debate, wondering what you think about empathogens versus, or feeling enhancers versus fantasy enhancers.
Yeah, so just sort of off the top of my head, it does make sense that, so when I went to the MAPS training for MDMA-assisted therapy, we got to watch a lot of footage from the trials.
Yeah.
Because they were training us to do this particular type of therapy support model with people on MDMA. And it seemed to me from the cases that I watched that people were experiencing sort of both on MDMA, certainly the feeling enhancement part. But for some, it was very, maybe it was by like through the pathway of feeling enhancement, they were able to approach memories that they couldn't approach before. Or they had visionary type experiences, not like the classic psychedelics like you're referring to. But I could see those two things being effective in conjunction, right? If you can be made capable of love, especially self-love, in a way that you didn't have access to before, in conjunction with the sort of fantasy enhancement, if I'm understanding what he means correctly, of being able to, you know, have a really, really interesting, novel psychedelic experience, a phenomenological experience that maybe is mystical and fantastical, but paired with love, you could make the argument that would, provide you with a novel experience that could be really, really powerful and therapeutic, like a connection with God or an ego dissolving experience that MDMA and MDA by itself don't always produce, right? There's not a whole lot of ego disillusionment in those medicines.
And that's what he said in his writings. He says from early testing, he got some from Gordon Alice, however you pronounce his name, and Sasha Shulgin. And so Claudio took some himself. He gave it to a few acquaintances. And he said something like, from this early testing, it seemed to enhance emotional awareness without interfering with thinking. So it didn't take you away from the ordinary world of people. And it seemed, he said, specific for processing the unfinished business of interpersonal wounds and trauma. I'll give you one example. Claudio then started giving it in clinic, and he had one middle-aged woman who came in, and he gave MDA to. And during this experience, she went back to childhood and had this recovery of a memory where she was locked in a room, saw through a window her father being killed by her mother's lover.
Wow.
And Claudio mentions that he doesn't know if this is true, but he believed it. Mm-hmm. And what really mattered was the remarkable healing that came in this woman's life from being able to work on some unfinished, very difficult business from her childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That does make sense. Again, referencing the MDMA MAPS therapy training, I think the feeling enhancement gave some of those participants access to memories that they didn't necessarily have ready access to because of an inability or an unwillingness to touch certain feelings.
Association from, too difficult to process. Yeah.
And maybe even memories that were emotion dependent. Like you have these memories that are connected to certain emotions, then hard to have access to them if you don't have access to the emotional state itself.
You know, we do a lot of PTSD studies down the road in our research clinic. And, you know, having done tons of those in a very structured way, diagnosing and assessing severity of the different symptom categories, you know, it's a very, it's one of the big parts of PTSD is the, and not for everyone, but for many people, there's an inability to remember some important parts of the event.
Right.
And it makes sense. Yeah. And like you're saying, there is the risk of, you know, that's very real and very common for many people of getting swept away by a trigger, whether it's, an emotion that's triggered or something that takes you back there and kind of bring you right back to that trauma right. moment.
Yeah, I should say this is more of a pet theory of mine and a few others than it is a really well-tested phenomenon. But just this idea that you're describing that... One of the mechanisms of action of something like MDMA or MDA is the feeling enhancement that then gives us access to, like I said before, memories that would have been harder to access because they're so triggering, right?
Yeah.
We back away from doing that work very understandably because it's terrifying or debilitating mm-hmm. to go back there and try to reprocess what happened to us that was traumatic.
Yeah. So the way he described a feeling enhancer was just having its primary effects on the emotional sphere by increasing awareness of your feelings, connection to, and then expression of them. Mm. But another interesting thing, so he says you could call it a feeling optimizer for feeling the optimal feeling that is love, which is, in his opinion, the psychological heart's blood.
Mm.
And he would acknowledge, just like we've talked about on here before, that it wasn't politically correct in academic circles to talk about love. But since you really can't avoid that topic in this work, meaning therapy work in general, it was just more tasteful, proper for people then to talk about empathy or positive emotional reinforcement. So he was coming from that lens, but there's a quote from the book I wanted to see what you think, from Claudio Naranjo. He says, "I believe that all of our emotional problems stem from a wrong attitude toward pain, a form of defensiveness to early experiences of pain that we weren't ready to face, that has become ingrained." So that's the quote. And then he goes on to say that the gate to happiness then is in finding another attitude toward pain and a way of being face to face with it. And he feels like MDA was particularly well suited to put you in that stance.
Hmm. I think that's pretty consistent with the way I approach psychotherapy as a clinician and my own lived experience of growth is that we've used the sort of the phrase on the show before that what we resist persists. And often we resist it because it's too painful. And it's one of the things I love about ketamine as a tool. Ketamine kind of has this effect too sometimes for people where it relaxes you enough and quiets the alarm bells that would typically go off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pain, so to speak, the emotional pain that would prevent you from approaching some of this difficult content. So that I could get down with that.
Yeah, yeah. And then... he said it's like a truth drug, a drug that doesn't, not like a truth serum of the movies that makes you spill truth against your will, but more of one that makes you concerned about truth and authenticity, right? And authenticity being another, like one of the other lifebloods of therapy work and self-awareness.
I will say, when you said truth drug, it reminded me of something from my notes about MDA. This Harold Blauer died in January of 1953 after being intravenously injected without his knowledge or consent with 450 milligrams of MDA as part of MK Ultra.
Oh, wow.
The idea that, you know, that this really controversial project in the 50s that the CIA or the US government was running to try to experiment with psychedelics as truth serums.
For like 20 years or something. Yeah, it's wild. And yeah, it's a little bit of a disturbing rabbit hole.
Well, so one of the things I wanted to cover with reference to MDA is you'll often hear it referred to as SAS or sassafras. So I thought we should speak to this because in my research, you can tell me if I'm wrong about this from what you know, there really isn't any naturally occurring MDA or MDMA like in the plant alkaloid world.
Yeah, SAS or sassafras is just the nickname for it, and I think not a great one because sassafras is indeed a plant, and a plant that is in fact banned since the late 70s in the US, but for completely different reasons than LSD. It's because it caused liver cancer in rats. And so when people say they're taking sassafras, I cringe a little because there's a toxic dose of that. Like 5 mL of sassafras
or saffron oil
will kill an adult. But that is not MDA. MDA is called sassafras because of the pathway of making it. Both MDA and MDA can be made derived from sassafras or saffron. Yeah.
So this is a little bit of a PSA because I know that there are people who participate in gray area or underground psychedelic ceremonies where they're told what we're giving you is all natural medicine, plant derived. Sometimes they're told it's legal because we're getting it from, you know, these random plants that we can distill it from or whatever. And so people are often told that they're given heart opener medicine and that it is SAS or sassafras. But if you look at like, you know, places like Arrowhead that have all this sort of knowledge, and all these chat rooms where people talk about psychedelic use, there's discussions on there where people have taken these medicines that they have been told are sassafras or SAS, had them tested, thoroughly tested, and they always come back as MDA or MDMA. Like there's no super secret plant alkaloid that they're giving you that's not MDMA or MDA.
Yeah, it's a really good point because like if you look at the history of sassafras, for example, it used to be given back in the late 1800s, 1900s by, well, I guess you could say eclectic physicians, but also snake oil physicians. It was given as a treatment for everything from UTIs to syphilis, head lice, eczema, and not without good evidence. Like we like to understandably complain these days about the regulatory environment and everything, but you know, there are pros and cons. Back then in the Wild West of some of this with limited understanding and less ethics boards of things, there were some big toxic surprises you'd encounter by self-experimentation and by taking something from your doctor.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Risky for sure. So be cautious if any of our listeners are in that scene or interested in that scene. If you're told that you're getting SAS, it's likely not some plant.
Yeah. There's a nice nonprofit that we saw at the MAPS conference. They were at other psychedelic conference we've been at, but Dance Safe makes test kits. And there are a lot of places you can get test kits, but as a harm reduction practice, it's just worth mentioning that it is a very smart idea these days to, if you're encountering these substances at all, you know, among, your circle, your loved ones, a test kit is a good idea. And, you know, you can do it by following instructions and really narrow down what something is and what something isn't. And people often, which is another good idea, have fentanyl strips to test everything that they encounter with those as well.
Yeah, we should underscore that point just in the interest of harm reduction, that if you choose to use illicit drugs, especially any that are in powder form, that at least testing them for fentanyl contamination is a smart move.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate how that has entered the drug market. Really scary thing and countless deaths from contamination, even when someone's expecting something completely different. And in fact, in Utah, I think I sent you the other day, there was a big fentanyl bust down in Spanish Fork, Utah, like millions of dollars or millions of pills, which is just, it's disturbing to think about where it's going.
Yeah, and I saw a post from DanceSafe, maybe on their Instagram, where they had received reports that they had some people had tested ketamine, that they had gotten some powdered ketamine.
Wow.
That had fentanyl, which is not something they had seen right in the past, that fentanyl usually wasn't stomped with ketamine. So,
yeah, I've seen some reports of people even going into a pharmacy in Mexico trying to buy things like a benzo or a sleep
Adderall
pill.
Yeah.
And having it contaminated, which is just frightening. Yeah.
I was in Mexico recently, and it was my first time in Mexico, and was surprised by all these corner pharmacies where you could get basically any drug.
Yeah.
Listed. And then I saw a news report where people had gone down to Mexico, acquired a lot of these pharmacy drugs, tested them. One of the examples was Adderall, and that close to 50% of the Adderall they tested had meth in it, as opposed to legit methamphetamine.
Yeah, I guess not surprising, because Adderall is amphetamine salts,
right?
And there are shortcuts made in the counterfeit arenas and in other countries shipping it in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, back to MDA, mm-hmm. the drug of, I guess, psychoanalysis, perhaps, is, I think it's worth dwelling just for another minute on this relationship with pain thing,
mm-hmm.
because I think it's so important. I agree with what you said. It's one of the key components of a healing journey and a growth path. You know, you could tie it into your mindset, growth versus fixed. Mm. But, you know, if there are some quotes from philosophers that we've talked about on here of like, you know, so many of our problems, our human problems, stem from our inability to sit still in a room alone or to sit with our discomfort. And we get these ingrained patterns. So anything that helps you take a new stance towards the discomfort, you know, and sit with it instead of swat it away, you know, like take a cold plunge in it, or mm-hmm. spray it up your nose through a monkey bone, or whatever your approach is to like sitting with discomfort, like in all your practices, doing that with your inner world is, I think, game changing on the healing journey.
Yeah. I would love to validate how hard it is to sit with one's discomfort.
Yeah.
And so, you know, oftentimes when we talk about resilience or grit, there's a subset of people who feel invalidated, right? Like, I don't want to be told that the pathway to mental wellness is developing a high emotional pain tolerance. I'm suffering here and I'm not really well supported.
Yeah.
So all those things being said, I still think it is relevant and true that to some extent, how well you can sit with discomfort correlates with how well you navigate the difficulties of your life and your overall mental well-being. Some of that's neurological, right? I mean, mm-hmm. if you can ride a dopamine lull, then your dopamine will reset and you're able to recover and you're able to like enjoy life again, those kinds of things. And it's our inability or low ability to sit with discomfort that often drives addiction. We talked quite a bit about that in our addiction episode.
Any patterns of avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And a lot of psychotherapies focus on that specifically, that mm-hmm. avoidance being the source of continued suffering. I'm remembering my training in acceptance and commitment therapy.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it was around mindful acceptance of discomfort and leaning in when we really want to lean out.
Yeah, which is at the heart of the psychedelic experience. Like when you go to an ayahuasca ceremony or a psychedelic dosing session of any kind, and when you take the medicine, you're essentially like consenting to be along for the ride, which is however many of hours, depending on the substance, where, you know, you can fight it and it'll be more difficult, as we've talked about a lot on here, or you can surrender to it and return with gifts. But that's part of how it works, in my opinion, is helping you practice in that supported way, mm-hmm. ideally supported, how to try on a new relationship with the hard things in life.
Yeah. I've come to start talking about surrender in terms of active versus passive surrender. Because sometimes when I'm telling my clients, when I'm trying to prep them for a psychedelic therapy session, that, you know, when in doubt, let go, be curious, be open, surrender, right?
Yeah.
Kind of like the things you're saying, that sometimes they feel like surrender is this sort of, I give up. And certainly you could talk about it in that kind of way, but I like the idea of active surrender, which is, I am willing to acknowledge that I don't have control in this situation, mm-hmm. especially important when you're on a psychedelic. And the return with gift sentiment's really important too, because I am willing to acknowledge that I don't have control and surrender so that I can be educated, so that I can be inspired, so that I can be shown, so that I can be healed. So it's an act of courage, certainly to surrender. It's not an act of sort of
defeat.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's, I liken it to skydiving. You know, where you're just you're taking the plunge, you're taking the leap, and then there's no turning back, right? So you need to surrender to what you just leaped into.
Yeah.
Or surfing, where you've got to, you know, in order to not crash and faceplant, you need to surrender to the waves you're riding, you know?
I like those analogies. Yeah. It wouldn't, after you jump out of an airplane, it wouldn't make much sense to try to claw your way back in, right? You're in the air. You might as well surrender to what's happening.
Resistance is futile. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, cool. So that's MDA. And I'll read you one more quote from Claudio to see what you think. But because he's kind of poetic in his writings. I'd recommend the Healing Journey book, by the way. It says, MDA helps you remain a healthy, loving child of paradise in spite of contamination of the past and pollution of the interpersonal world.
Hmm. I love that. In spite of those things, acknowledging that we have those pollutions, to speak.
Yeah. And it goes along with his overall theory of psychedelic therapy is that it helps cleanse a psyche of dysfunctional imprints from childhood and recover your ability to love, which I quite like.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, as we stated before, that could easily be applied to MDMA too. I don't know that that's specifically unique to MDA. Would be my guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So there, and we do see, I think that's another important disclaimer. We see a lot of overlap among substances in the broader psychedelic class, where, you know, there are plenty of people in our psychedelic study dosing sessions, whether it's LSD, psilocybin, et cetera, who experience, a sense of empathy, mm-hmm. unity, interconnectedness, and love for all beings. Mm-hmm. And MDMA is unique in its ability to occasion that in a pretty substantial way without, you know, altering the world in such a weird way. Mm-hmm. And MDA is like somewhere on that spectrum too, right? Between the MDMA on one extreme of the empathogens and the classic psychedelics on the other.
Yeah. And I don't know if we covered it, but of course there are, we talked about it in terms of like the high dose being potentially lethal, but, these, MDMA can also have some pretty, unpleasant effects as well.
MDA, excuse me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And MDMA, of course, but, and there's a neurotoxic threshold of both these things as stimulants, belonging to that class as well.
But same kind of like jaw clenching and tightness at higher doses and like hyperthermia and dehydration risk and potential cardiac risk if you have preconditions with cardiac or blood pressure issues.
All of these things, even the classic psychedelics, raise heart rate, blood pressure transiently, and especially the stimulant and pathogens. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, should we move on to, you want to move on to Kana?
Sure.
Talk a little bit about Kana.
Not as much to say about that one, but let's decipher it a wee bit so people know what they might be putting under their tongue if passed a tincture at a conference or something.
I was going to try to pronounce the plant name. I don't think I'm going to be able to. Scletium tortosum. Yeah, I probably butchered that.
Yeah, that first part of it's from the root word for skeleton, Slidium. Because of how it's a succulent, right? Mm-hmm. Kana. And because of how the leaves look, I think when dried out, they kind of have a Skeletor kind of look.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Native South African succulent, mm-hmm. I think, right?
Khoi tribes.
Mm.
Yeah, which is interesting. It's like it's, I think the name kana means chew or chewable. So it just shows you how they would use it traditionally for a lot of things, like many plant medicines, like to elevate mood or to reduce stress or to for its slightly calming properties.
Yeah, and when I did partake of one of those kana samples they were given out at MAPS, and they had other plant stuffs in there. So this particular sample was in a dropper, and I put it in my mouth, and it felt like I had licked a D battery. Like I had buzzing in my mouth. And I asked them about that, and they said that's actually a different plant that they'd put in there for, I don't know, kicks and giggles. But yeah, so it's often used in conjunction with other psychedelics. I mean, I say often used, not in the in a clinical sense. We're not studying kana. I don't know that anybody else is, but I know of
some case reports and one small trial of kana for mood.
Mm.
Yeah.
But thought to have some, in addition to what you said, to be a little heart opening, kind of like I was referring to with the other things, making you feel warm and juicy inside and a little euphoric. And interesting that it can be, depending on the person and maybe depending on the dose, both calming and stimulating.
Yeah. Yeah. So I saw on Psychonaut Wiki, which I like that site. You know, I know Third Wave, of course, has great resources, but like the gal behind Psychonaut Wiki, Josie Kleins, is a kind of a psychedelic genius in her own right. Really interesting if you watch any of her videos, breaking down the psychedelic experience. Like, I don't know anyone who can describe the DMT experience as well as she can, for example, besides maybe Terrence McKenna, who spent his life pursuing that goal.
And these are on YouTube, right? You can hear her talking about these on YouTube.
Yeah, but Psychonaut Wiki talks about how kana, if it's snorted, is stimulating or smoked, but other routes like sublingual are more sedating. Yeah, so kind of dose dependent. Like, we'll talk about salvia next, but salvia has some of that sedating and properties as well.
So this is me being a non-physician. Is that because when you ingest it orally, kind of like cannabis, there's some metabolites that happen while it passes through digestion that might have a different psychoactive effect?
You know, it could be. I don't know why. I think kana is a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and it works on like dopamine and norepinephrine through this mechanism called VMAT2, like upregulation a little bit. And I think these are relatively mild, their effects, but I think it's the route of administration like matters in the sense that the slope of the curve of those kind of effects is so much more dramatic and therefore more noticeable as you're consuming it in a intranasal or inhaled or sublingual way than letting it pass through even sublingual absorption or in through the gut, especially. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd be curious what to know, like what is the neurotransmitter combination that allows for relaxed alertness?
That reminds me of another one that, we won't dive into here, but phenibut.
Oh yeah.
Kind of gray area, nootropic, nootropic, that was used by Russian cosmonauts to stay awake but relaxed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard some people who take Adderall report that it's sort of this relaxed alertness, but also other people who take it who feel like they're on freaking cocaine and they're buzzing.
Yeah, so sometimes, like with phenibut, it's kind of a combined GABA mechanism with a little like upregulation of those things like dopamine. Mm. So you could see how it can coexist either based on the neurotransmitters, or it can be more noticeable based on your route in a given thing that's going to be, yeah, has maybe one pathway that's stimulating and one that's calming. Yeah.
Here's a quote from one sort of case report. Several users felt that the relaxation induced by kana enabled one to focus on inner thoughts and feelings if wished, or to concentrate on the beauty of nature. So you could have a little bit, because it's not so psychoactive, and that you had some control over the experience. Also thought to act as an aphrodisiac, increasing sort of the feeling of sensation of touch. Sensitivity to skin, of your skin to touch, And then higher doses, especially if you combine it with cannabis, which is, this is the case with a lot of drugs. Cannabis tends to be an amplifier.
Yep.
That it can produce mild visions, visual hallucinations.
Cannabis is the great amplifier of amplifiers. Like if you scroll down on any entry on Psychonaut Wiki, say you're looking at MDA or 4-ACO-DMT or something like that, there'll be the section on how does it combine with other medicines, and the cannabis one is almost universally, you know, anecdotal reports show that it can really intensify the experience, the visuals, etc., and may lead to increased risk of paranoia. Yeah.
And this is not advice, folks. This is for educational purposes only. Reed and I are not recommending you start combining cannabis with other drugs.
To get more paranoia.
Although I will say Phil Wolfson, the godfather of ketamine-assisted therapy, is a huge fan, and he's very public about being a fan of combining cannabis with ketamine-assisted therapy.
Yeah, and I'm also a huge urger of caution. Mm-hmm. Is that a word? When it comes to combining those things.
Yeah.
Because, these things can be beautiful synergies in some, but they can also be huge risks of an unexpected, difficult experience in others, mm-hmm. right? Like, there's a lot of literature on psilocybin and cannabis, and that's one of the two big risk factors of a difficult trip would be combining with cannabis and not having a sober guide.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, psychedelics, especially the so-called classic psychedelics, are such a roll of the dice anyway. We talk so much about set and setting, the sort of the levers that you can pull to influence the psychedelic experience to make it therapeutic or to hopefully make it therapeutic. When you introduce something like cannabis, you're introducing another handful of dice.
Yeah, and it's complicated by the fact that back in the day, like Tim Leary and friends would combine their psychedelics with massive doses of cannabis, mm-hmm. like hashish or whatever. And you can get to some trippy states that way. And they did, but they also knew the medicines very intimately on the path to doing those kind of combos. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also read some case reports about Kana being giving people headaches, mm-hmm. some GI distress, loss of appetite.
Heartburn, nausea. Mm-hmm.
And even depressed mood in some people. I mean, you mentioned it being you said it was an SSRI?
A serotonin, not a selective one, but a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, say mildly speaking. But but interestingly, there are, like, people use Kana for, like, mood lifting, euphoric type effects, you know, usually a mild effect, but the studies that have looked at it, like some case reports and one more clinically designed study, were looking at it and did find some anxiolytic and antidepressant effects. I don't expect to see it coming down the pipeline anytime soon or huge effect sizes, but I think the point is there is something there, and like many of these plant medicines that we don't study in a detailed way in these clinical trials, we also don't have a good inventory of the rate of these side effects and the dose at which they appear and everything. And that would be nice to have, but we just don't.
Right. So, you know, why did we choose to talk about it if there is not a plethora of data? It's because it's so popular. Like, you go into a lot of these wellness shops or cannabis shops or whatever, there's a lot of Kana added to supplements or getting Kana by itself. So, given its popularity, we thought we would just speak to it a little bit.
Yeah, and these, you can liken these subjective effects that you find on sites like Psychonaut Wiki, Third Wave, Wikipedia, Reddit, Airwood, mm-hmm. etc., to kind of like leafly reviews, which are super fun to read, by the way. Like, I just like to read them because they're hilarious. Mm-hmm. But they're based on the number of people who report having, say, dry eyes on a given strain or increased energy and focus versus sedation on a given strain. And it's not a simple matter of sativa versus indica, although there are some patterns there.
Right.
It's, it's when you have a strain that has thousands of reviews and thousands of people who have mentioned or clicked a box of a certain thing, I start to trust it more. But this is like the early observational research phase. And that's where a lot of these, like, reports of like, you know, increased sensitivity to touch and appreciation of music, things like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not brain scanned yet.
Right. Yeah. Not that kind of detailed data. Those surveys, you know, or I don't know what you'd call them, convenience samples or whatever, they can be informative, but it's not the most thorough way to use the scientific method, so we can't say things definitively. But yeah, I think that's how a lot of the microdosing research was done or is being done. It's polling people who say they are active microdosers, for example.
I think, yeah.
What's his name? Jim Fadiman has a bunch of data.
There's a selection bias to self-report survey data.
Right.
Yeah. And it's just, it's useful with that caveat. Yeah. Like if you look at under Kana, you go scroll down to the effects and you find libido. It'll say like some users report increased libido and others report decreased libido as some, like you'd see on SSRIs, for example. So, how to use that information? I don't know.
Could very well be a placebo, right? I mean, if people take something hoping that it'll make them horny, you know, maybe it was their hope.
Loosely held hope.
Loosely yeah. held hope. There you go. Cool. Anything else you got on Kana before we move on to salvia?
Oh, let's get to salvia. That's a crazy one. Mm.
This perennial herb of yeah. the largest, I'm reading my notes here, genus of plants in the, another word I'm going to butcher, I'm not even trying to say it, but it's like a mint family.
Yeah. Yeah. It's even though you might think from the genus and species that it's a sage, it's actually a mint, but a really intriguing one at that, because, you know, if you look at the ceremonial use from what Mazateca communities, Oaxaca, it's used in shamanic rituals for healing, for
divination.
Yeah, divination for even healing of certain ailments.
And is that the one that, I mean, the different routes of administration, I guess you say, but getting in your body, but people will, is that they chew the leaves?
Yeah, as far as I know.
It's made into a tea or they yeah, can smoke it too, I guess.
From the shamanic uses that I've read about, most of them would have a like chew on leaves kind of route of administration. But there's this interesting condition called Panzón de Borrega. Mm. I forget what it means. Lamb belly.
So, lamb belly.
Yeah, lamb belly. So this condition is a swollen stomach that comes from a curse by a sorcerer who has placed a stone inside the sufferer.
Makes sense.
And so if you rewind like 100 years and go to certain regions where salvia was used in rituals like this, the shaman would either take it or take it and give it to the client. And then they'd have a visionary experience and do some rituals. And salvia was thought to be a remedy for that lamb's belly. Panzón de Borrega. I love those kind of conditions
yeah,
for their anthropological intrigue.
Yeah. So the experience on salvia, maybe we could talk a bit about that. So people talk about it physiologically, a tingling sensation, increased awareness of the body, enhanced clarity or presence of mind, but at higher doses associated with a sort of ego dissolving like other psychedelics, fast changing visuals, pretty intense, most people report. A physical impairment or dizziness, and some mystical type experiences.
And so salvia, like we were just saying, depends on how you take it. Like if you're taking leaves, like I think Gordon Wasson, who had that Time Life magazine article on Maria Sabina after his trek down there with his wife, the real mycologist,
Valentina.
So Gordon took salvia in a ceremonial way. This is like 1961 or something. And he was given like 60 leaves to chew on and hold sublingually. And then he had saw some three-dimensional visions. It came on faster than mushrooms, he said, lasted a little shorter. Like it's a 30, 60 minute thing. And so then he gave it to Albert Hofmann and they took it together. And Albert Hofmann like gave it to his wife as well and friends. And that's how it worked back then. It was kind of interesting. And it's cool to hear their report because they knew quite well these other substances too.
I love hearing these stories of like the psychedelic super friends of the,
yeah,
the 50s, 60s and 70s and, just being sort of cowboy in their ways of experiencing and testing these psychedelics.
Yeah. And
interesting stories.
The interesting thing about the shamanic use too, is in order to, so we had our like American and European psychonaut explorers who were, taking it, these chemists and everything else. But in the shamanic uses, you would need to apprentice for years with someone and do, I don't know what they're called down there, but dieta, I might even call it dieta, but you would do like a dieta with salvia for a couple weeks at a time, where you're, and with this idea, like in the dieta community in ayahuasca circles, with this idea that if you don't complete the dieta, there could be even a curse involved or the plant itself might turn on you. And the idea was if you don't complete the salvia dieta, that you, it could lead to madness. So it's just, I'm just trying to put myself in the position of someone in training, going through that and just how that would feel to be going through something so difficult, but also so worried about what happens if you don't complete it.
Yeah. Reminds me of our conversation with Rachel Harris about ayahuasca. And, yeah, and mushrooms, like these are the all the healers, these female healers that she interviewed that did had to apprentice for years in some cases before they could serve the medicine and diet on the plants, yeah, or on the substances that they were serving.
So salvia, the effects you were just talking about are like most people these days in the Western world or in North America anyway, smoke it. And it's a pretty potent hallucinogen when smoked. I think it's a little less potent by milligram or microgram than LSD, but to smoke 250 to 500 micrograms of salvia is a very potent hallucinogenic experience, even though it's not a classic psychedelic. It's doing a lot of, you know, very trippy things when you take it that way.
Yeah, I read reports of tunnel vision, like intense tunnel vision, of visual hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, pretty intense ego disillusionment,
and ego
laughing uncontrollably, like, yeah, hearing voices.
Fits. There are a lot of people on YouTube doing salvia because it's legal in what, like half the states, including in Utah. The best I can tell, I've never experienced salvia. I don't really plan to. I find it intriguing and jarring to hear about people's experiences or see them on YouTube. You know, I've had friends report firsthand that they've had some really sketchy experiences on salvia where, you know, it's this half an hour trip, but it hits so fast. And there's this, what's called salvia gravity, like where it, you're almost like ripped up and out of your body and pulled down to the earth, and gravity is like turned on its side. And then you're losing motor control. Your bodily form might be changing, the shape and size of things around you. Like there's a high rate of terrifying experiences on salvia and a high rate of those showing up on YouTube videos where people do salvia.
Yeah. When I hear about experiences with specific plants, compounds, medicines, or whatever like this, I always think, so what is it that is unique about salvia? Like if I'm taking it for psychedelic healing, or if it gets studied and proven to be effective for psychedelic assisted therapy, what does it do that other psychedelics that aren't so freaking terrifying don't do?
Yeah. And it's, so that brings up this question of how do you classify it? What is it most like? It's not,
cause it's not a serotonin receptor agonist.
No,
right?
It's a kappa opioid agonist that would be best classified, in my opinion, as a like an atypical dissociative hallucinogen. You know, and Matt Johnson and colleagues at Hopkins are studying salvia. They've been able to give it to some volunteers and brain scanners, which is cool. And there is increased entropy. There is decreased default mode. They've looked at some of that, but the experience is somewhere in between, like a high dose LSD psilocybin and a dissociative, like ketamine, DXM, PCP even. Mm. Like it reminds me in some ways of PCP that has a high rate of like very dysphoric, terrifying experiences, which is one of the caveats of salvia usage.
Yeah, interesting that they're studying it then. At Hopkins, yeah. Again, like what's the draw?
Yeah, what is the draw? I mean, it's it has this rich history, like as a tool in divination and healing, and it's also not very well known. Like doing such a dramatic, like if we can understand salvia, we can understand more about the brain, I think, because it has these open eye distortions that are more simple than classic psychedelics, but more profound in some ways. Like they show up at earlier doses. Some say the world is flattened, like 3D, where you don't know, you don't have any depth perception. You have that shifting of spatial orientation on its side. And then sometimes there's like scenery slicing, like you'd see in a glitch painting, like a whole sliver of what you see out there is just displaced one way or another, might be waving back and forth. Hmm. Or there might be another one is environmental cubism, like where the whole world turns into blocks of things. Like you're looking at it from different angles.
Huh. Yeah. Makes you wonder which sort of Renaissance age painters
yeah.
maybe would have used salvia.
I know, because Picasso is probably the best known artist to bring in cubism. And I got really curious about that. Like, did he use salvia? Mm-hmm. And I can't find any evidence that he did, but Picasso was notorious for his opium use. Mm-hmm. Opium, cannabis, alcohol, a number of things like that. And although, and they had these opium dens, it was often at Pablo Picasso's apartment, his studio apartment by like the Moulin Rouge or Montmartre, where there was this question people have looking back on it is, did that influence his art, or was he a tortured, troubled artist who used this to get some relief from the daily pain? And, you know, I think the answer isn't so simple, but it seems to be more, he was using it for a time as an escape. And then there was this really tragic incident of one of his painter friends on opium combined with a bunch of other stuff, hashish, etc., hung himself. Mm. And Pablo Picasso found him. Mm. And so Pablo and his lover, partner, whatever they were, said right then and there, we're never touching again. And they didn't. Yeah. Oh. It shook them up way too much, understandably.
Well, the story did make me think of a few things I read about salvia and people using it in lower doses to aid in meditation, to help with depression. I mean, the higher dose experiences you describe sound terrifying. I don't know how that would be very super helpful with depression. But also, there was a 2009 study that found when cocaine-addicted rats were exposed to salvinorin A, that their cocaine-seeking behavior, so the pushing of the lever to self-administer cocaine, decreased, became less frequent.
Yeah, interesting. There have been those animal studies on addiction, particularly cocaine addiction with it, which, but in one of those papers, I remember seeing some mention that I thought was curious of the clinical, practical utility or application of salvia is a little tricky. Mm-hmm. You know, just the experience and how it's given and, you know, to find a pathway. It's, I guess, not surprising that people haven't pursued it in drug development for a lot of these reasons.
Yeah. You know? And maybe as a little aside about rat studies, you know, rats aren't people, and not everything that is shown to have an effect in rodent models will then translate to human beings.
Yep.
And the wellness industry is sort of, hey, take this pill, it'll solve all your problems, rub this oil on your face, it'll solve all your problems. They're notorious for citing studies that quote unquote support the use of their thing, and those studies being rodent studies. So be on the lookout.
Yep. Yeah, it's true. So salvia, why is it interesting? And like we were saying, to understand the brain, maybe some therapeutic applications, but more maybe therapeutic targets as we understand the brain. But I've just found it intriguing, this mechanism, like this, I guess the structure of the the hallucinogenic experience on salvia is a different kind of geometry, people say. We're talking about cubism, but there's this idea of like a transforming machinescape that is in one part more simple than DMT, but also more vast, because as your dose increases, like essentially the whole universe becomes this geometric thing. And what's especially different from ketamine and others is that you become part of it. You actually feel it. Like there can be these intense pins and needles on salvia where it could be a wildly uncomfortable somatic experience as the machinescape is transforming, and it is all of you, and it's the whole universe condensed into this like single pointed machine that's morphing over your like time warp trip.
That's really interesting. Did you ever read anybody talking about entity encounters on
salvia? Yeah, there's some of that. I don't know rates or you know, we saw that data from Roland Griffiths at the conference recently about near-death experiences versus spontaneous spiritual ones and psilocybin ones, and what kind of entities and the outcome of the experience. But I think in general, just salvia has more terrifying encounters.
Yeah.
And where you can actually, there's ego replacement that can happen, where you can take the form of either a fictional character or a plant or an animal and become identified with it, which sounds kind of wild too.
I heard somebody give a trip report about salvia and saying that they became a chair leg, which that's pretty interesting. But yeah, it when I allow my mind to get really curious and kind of, creative and fantasize a bit, it makes me wonder, you know, people often talk about this in reference to DMT, that it's shifting the channel in your mind, giving you access to something that's there, right? That the entities or the universes, the places, the dimensions you visit on DMT, they feel more real than real life to some people. And it's fun to speculate what that means.
Yeah,
it could just
be,
you know, this is what the human brain does when it's altered in these ways. And there's nothing necessarily metaphysically real about these places that people experience. But it's also fun to think, you know, are we being transported places? And if so, are the salvia places in a different dimension than the DMT places? I'm just being playful.
People. Yeah. I heard, I think Rick Strassman on Joe Rogan was asked that question of like, what is the, where's DMT land? Where are you going when you go there and encounter these entities like more than half the time? And, I liked his answer is like, I don't know.
Yeah.
How would we know? I don't know if it's another dimension or a neurochemical reaction in my brain, but, or both.
Yeah. I love answering, I don't know. And maybe it's like a twisted pleasure in myself, because you know, I've got a lot of education, and understandably people would ask me certain questions about, consciousness and the human mind, expecting a really definitive answer. But it's one of those weird things. I forget what the principle is, but like the more you learn, the more you discover that you don't know.
It's like a principle from Socrates, those dudes, you know, Buddha. Yeah, just going back to those realizations that we definitely don't have all the answers, and we give up the fight to pretend like we do or need to.
Yeah, certainly comforting for me.
Yeah,
being a
me
person
too.
Who used to try to cling to certainty and to figure out the truth of all things, to finally accept that I have very little access to most of the truths I want to have access to, and that's okay. I am pleasantly surprised by the grand mystery each day.
I like how you said that, and that's something that I've learned from psychedelic experiences and just being in this work, is to give up the need to try and understand it all. Like give up the need to have the answers and try and slip more into that living the question with curiosity and not attached to ever knowing, you know.
I like that. And I like the replacement of like the need to know with curiosity. For me, like we're both scientists in our own right, right? Trained in different ways and focus on different problems, but we like to approach the difficult questions of human consciousness and the psyche with a scientific mindset. But science, I don't know, at least in my opinion, especially social science, is not necessarily about proving the nature of things. It's about investigating curiosities. And there are endless curiosities to investigate, especially when it comes to the human mind.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why people have gone to Salvia and MDA and all these others to explore the mysteries of, like, consciousness, right?
Yeah.
You know, in large part, and why people still do, like, what were we just hearing about? There's apparently someone on YouTube who has a gardening channel on Salvia where they, like, spontaneously melt into a non-functional human as the medicine kicks in. But it's a really intriguing and frightening one, to be mm-hmm. honest, we talk about the dangers of psychedelic experience, the difficult experiences, the kind of the
destabilizing experiences.
Yeah, paranoia, yeah. Psychosis-like symptoms that could result at the peak of high-dose experiences or even afterwards in some people at risk. But with Salvia, you're rolling dice on having, like, a sense of fear, impending doom, like some of those scary substances like PCP, if right. you don't know what you're doing.
Right. Even if you do know what you're doing, yeah. you're still rolling dice, right? Cool. Well, anything else about Salvia that you think we ought to share with the audience?
You know, I don't know. I don't follow its legal status. I don't have a particular academic interest or any, like, personal relationship with the plant. But I did see that in Utah, the legal status depends on the state in the U.S. And in Utah, it was tried. There was a representative, what was his name, Paul Ray, back in like 15 years ago. There was a KSL news story that ran saying this was a dangerous herb.
I remember hearing about this as a younger person. I wasn't a kid back then.
Yeah, so the next day, Representative Paul Ray files legislation or presents legislation to ban it. And it didn't make it. The next year he tries again, and the state said, you know, we realize this is a tricky one. We're working on other ways of regulating, controlling. It didn't go anywhere. And then he was fired up. The next year after that, he tried again and it failed. Mm-hmm. So as far as I know, it's still sold in some smoke shops or things. I don't know, but the one interesting thing is, people can get tinctures. People can get these, like, this liquid version of it where it's labeled in 5X or 10X or 80X. And what that means is that it's 5X is like 5 times more concentrated than just the ground leaf powder mm-hmm. alone, or 80X. So that's another harm reduction buyer beware trick. If anyone is, contemplating touching this quite scary plant medicine.
Good harm reduction education. Well, cool. We've got other sort of lesser known psychedelic compounds that we might investigate in the future. We talked about maybe discussing 2CB in more detail.
One of Shulgin's favorites.
Yeah. He called it, I have a little quote here as a sort of a preview. One of his favorites, one of the most graceful, erotic, sensual, introspective compounds I have ever invented. So how's that for a teaser trailer?
Ooh. Can't wait.
Yeah, I love the idea of an erotic psychedelic.
Well, it's always a pleasure talking shop with you, Steve.
Likewise. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel. Like the videos. And share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.